I wished him well wherever he was. If he'd made it back to Germany by now, and he should have, I hoped he was happy. He hadn't written yet to give me his address, but I was sure I'd hear something before long. And my daughter, God love her and keep her. I hoped she was doing okay. I decided to write her a letter that evening and tell her I was rooting for her. My mother was alive and more or less in good health, and I felt lucky there too. If all went well, I'd have her for several more years. Birds were calling, and some cars passed me on the highway. Good luck to you too, brother, I thought. I hope your ship comes in. Pay me back when you get it. And my former wife, the woman I used to love so much, she was alive, and she was well too. So far as I knew, anyway. I wished her happiness. When all was said and done, I decided things could be a lot worse. Just now, of course, things were hard for everyone. People's luck had gone south on them, was all. But things were bound to change soon. Things would pick up in the fall, maybe. There was lots to hope for. I kept on walking. Then I began to whistle. I felt I had the right to whistle if I wanted to. I let my arms swing as I walked. But the lunch pail kept throwing me off balance. I had sandwiches, an apple, and some cookies in there, not to mention the thermos. I stopped in front of Smitty's, an old cafe that had gravel in the parking area and boards over the windows. The place had been boarded up for as long as I could remember. I decided to put the lunch pail down for a minute. I did that, and then I raised my arms. Raised them up level with my shoulders. I was standing there like that, like a goof, when somebody tooted a car horn and pulled off the highway into the parking area. I picked up my lunch pail and went over to the car. It was a guy I knew from work whose name was George. He reached over and opened the door on the passenger's side. "Hey, get in, buddy," he said. "Hello, George," I said. I got in and shut the door, and the car sped off, throwing gravel from under the tires. "I saw you," George said. "Yeah, I did, I saw you. You're in training for something, but I don't know what." He looked at me and then looked at the road again. He was going fast. "You always walk down the road with your arms out like that?" He laughed, ha ha ha, and stepped on the gas. "Sometimes," I said. "It depends, I guess." Actually, I was standing, I said. I lit a cigarette and leaned back in the seat. "So what's new?" George said. He put a cigar in his mouth, but he didn't light it. "Nothing's new," I said. "What's new with you?" George shrugged. Then he grinned. He was going very fast now. Wind buffeted the car and whistled by outside the windows. He was driving as if we were late for work. But we weren't late. We had lots of time, and I told him so. Nevertheless, he cranked it up. We passed the turnoff and kept going. We were moving by then, heading straight toward the mountains. He took the cigar out of his mouth and put it in his shirt pocket. "I borrowed some money and had this baby overhauled," he said. Then he said he wanted me to see something. He punched it and gave it everything he could. I fastened my seatbelt and held on. "Go," I said. "What are you waiting for, George?" And that's when we really flew. Wind howled outside the windows. He had it floored and we were going flat out. We streaked down that road in his big, unpaid-for car. Blackbird Pie. I was in my room one night when I heard something in the corridor. I looked up from my work and saw an envelope slide under the door. It was a thick envelope, but not so thick it couldn't be pushed under the door. My name was written on the envelope, and what was inside purported to be a letter from my wife. I say purported because even though the grievances could only have come from someone who'd spent 23 years observing me on an intimate day-to-day basis, the charges were outrageous and completely out of keeping with my wife's character. Most important, however, the handwriting was not my wife's handwriting. But if it wasn't her handwriting, then whose was it? I wish now I'd kept the letter so I could reproduce it down to the last comma, the last uncharitable exclamation point. The tone is what I'm talking about now, not just the content. But I didn't keep it, I'm sorry to say. I lost it, or else misplaced it. Later, after the sorry business I'm about to relate, I was cleaning out my desk and may have accidentally thrown it away, which is uncharacteristic of me, since I usually don't throw anything away. In any case, I have a good memory. I can recall every word of what I read. My memory is such that I used to win prizes in school because of my ability to remember names and dates, inventions, battles, treaties, alliances, and the like. I always scored highest on factual tests, and in later years, in the real world, as it's called, my memory stood me in good stead. For instance, if I were asked right now to give the details of the Council of Trent or the Treaty of Utrecht, or to talk about Carthage, the city razed by the Romans after Hannibal's defeat, the Roman soldiers plowed salt into the ground so that Carthage could never be called Carthage again, I could do so. Note, Council of Trent. Roman Catholic Council, 1545 to 63, convened by Pope Paul III to address church doctrine and institutional reform in the wake of the Protestant Reformation. End of note. Note, Treaty of Utrecht. Treaty signed in 1713, marking the end of the War of the Spanish Succession. End of note. If called upon to talk about the Seven Years' War, the 30 Years, or the 100 Years' War, or simply the First Silesian War, I could hold forth with the greatest enthusiasm and confidence. Note, First Silesian War, fought from 1740 to 1742, the first of two wars between Prussia and Austria and its allies, for control of the central European region of Silesia. End of note. Ask me anything about the Tartars, the Renaissance popes, or the rise and fall of the Ottoman Empire. Thermopylae, Shiloh, or the Maxim gun. Note, Thermopylae, Shiloh. Thermopylae, site in Greece of several battles in antiquity, most notably the two-day standoff in 480 BCE between Greek troops and a far more numerous force of Persian forces. Shiloh, Civil War battle, April 6-7, 1862, fought in western Tennessee. End of note. Note, Maxim gun. Machine gun invented in 1884 by Hiram Stevens Maxim, 1840-1916. End of note.
Easy. Tannenberg?
Note, the name of two notable battles. The First Battle of Tannenberg, 1410, also known as the Battle of Grunwald, resulted in the Knights of the Teutonic Order being soundly defeated by Polish and Lithuanian forces. The Second Battle of Tannenberg, 1914, was a German victory against the Russians in early World War I. End of note.
Simple as blackbird pie. The famous 4 and 20 that were set before the king.
Note, from the nursery rhyme, Sing a Song of Sixpence. Sing a song of sixpence, a pocket full of rye. 4 and 20 blackbirds baked in a pie. When the pie was opened, the birds began to sing. Wasn't that a dainty dish to set before the king? End of note.
At Agincourt, English longbows carried the day. And here's something else. Everyone has heard of the Battle of Lepanto, the last great sea battle fought in ships powered by galley slaves. This fracas took place in 1571 in the eastern Mediterranean, when the combined naval forces of the Christian nations of Europe turned back the Arab hordes under the infamous Ali Muezzin Zadeh, a man who was fond of personally cutting off the noses of his prisoners before calling in the executioners. But does anyone remember that Cervantes was involved in this affair and had his left hand lopped off in the battle? Something else. The combined French and Russian losses in one day at Borodino were 75,000 men, the equivalent in fatalities of a fully loaded jumbo jet crashing every 3 minutes from breakfast to sundown. Kutuzov pulled his forces back toward Moscow. Napoleon drew breath, marshaled his troops, and continued his advance. He entered the downtown area of Moscow, where he stayed for a month waiting for Kutuzov, who never showed his face again. The Russian generalissimo was waiting for snow and ice for Napoleon to begin his retreat to France. Things stick in my head. I remember. So when I say I can recreate the letter, the portion that I read, which catalogs the charges against me, I mean what I say. In part, the letter went as follows. Dear, things are not good. Things, in fact, are bad. Things have gone from bad to worse. And you know what I'm talking about. We've come to the end of the line. It's over with us. Still, I find myself wishing we could have talked about it. It's been such a long time now since we've talked. I mean, really talked. Even after we were married, we used to talk and talk, exchanging news and ideas. When the children were little, or even after they were more grown up, we still found time to talk. It was more difficult then, naturally, but we managed. We found time. We made time. We'd have to wait until after they were asleep, or else when they were playing outside or with a sitter, but we managed. Sometimes we'd engage a sitter just so we could talk. On occasion, we talked the night away, talked until the sun came up. Well, things happen, I know. Things change. Bill had that trouble with the police, and Linda found herself pregnant, etc. Our quiet time together flew out the window, and gradually your responsibilities backed up on you. Your work became more important, and our time together was squeezed out. Then, once the children left home, our time for talking was back. We had each other again, only we had less and less to talk about. It happens, I can hear some wise man saying, and he's right. It happens. But it happened to us. In any case, no blame. No blame. That's not what this letter is about. I want to talk about us. I want to talk about now. The time has come, you see, to admit that the impossible has happened. To cry uncle. To beg off. To... I read this far and stopped. Something was wrong. Something was fishy in Denmark. The sentiments expressed in the letter may have belonged to my wife. Maybe they did. Say they did. Grant that the sentiments expressed were hers. But the handwriting was not her handwriting. And I ought to know. I consider myself an expert in this matter of her handwriting. And yet, if it wasn't her handwriting, who on earth had written these lines? I should say a little something about ourselves and our life here. During the time I'm writing about, we were living in a house we'd taken for the summer. I'd just recovered from an illness that had set me back in most things I'd hoped to accomplish that spring. We were surrounded on three sides by meadows, birch woods, and some low rolling hills. A territorial view, as the realtor had called it when he described it to us over the phone. In front of the house was a lawn that had grown shaggy, owing to lack of interest on my part, and a long graveled drive that led to the road. Behind the road, we could see the distant peaks of mountains, thus the phrase, territorial view, having to do with a vista appreciated only at a distance. My wife had no friends here in the country, and no one came to visit. Frankly, I was glad for the solitude, but she was a woman who was used to having friends, used to dealing with shopkeepers and tradesmen. Out here, it was just the two of us, thrown back on our resources. Once upon a time, a house in the country would have been our ideal. We would have coveted such an arrangement. Now I can see it wasn't such a good idea. No, it wasn't. Both our children had left home long ago. Now and then a letter came from one of them, and once in a blue moon, on a holiday, say, one of them might telephone. A collect call, naturally, my wife being only too happy to accept the charges. This seeming indifference on their part was, I believe, a major cause of my wife's sadness and general discontent. A discontent, I have to admit, I'd been vaguely aware of before our move to the country. In any case, to find herself in the country after so many years of living close to a shopping mall and bus service, with a taxi no farther away than the telephone in the hall, it must have been hard on her, very hard. I think her decline, as a historian might put it, was accelerated by our move to the country. I think she slipped a cog after that. I'm speaking from hindsight, of course, which always tends to confirm the obvious. I don't know what else to say in regard to this matter of the handwriting. How much more can I say and still retain credibility? We were alone in the house. No one else, to my knowledge anyway, was in the house and could have penned the letter. Yet I remain convinced to this day that it was not her handwriting that covered the pages of the letter. After all, I'd been reading my wife's handwriting since before she was my wife. As far back as what might be called our pre-history days. The time she went away to school as a girl, wearing a gray and white school uniform. She wrote letters to me every day that she was away, and she was away for 2 years, not counting holidays and summer vacations. Altogether, in the course of our relationship, I would estimate, a conservative estimate too, counting our separations and the short periods of time I was away on business or in the hospital, etc., I would estimate, as I say, that I received 1,700 or possibly 1,850 handwritten letters from her, not to mention hundreds, maybe thousands, more informal notes. On your way home, please pick up dry cleaning and some spinach pasta from Corti Brothers. I could recognize her handwriting anywhere in the world. Give me a few words. I'm confident that if I were in Jaffa or Marrakesh and picked up a note in the marketplace, I would recognize it if it was my wife's handwriting. A word, even. Take this word, talked, for instance. That simply isn't the way she'd write talked. Yet I'm the first to admit I don't know whose handwriting it is if it isn't hers. Secondly, my wife never underlined her words for emphasis. Never. I don't recall a single instance of her doing this, not once in our entire married life. Not to mention the letters I received from her before we were married. It would be reasonable enough, I suppose, to point out that it could happen to anyone. That is, anyone could find himself in a situation that is completely atypical and, given the pressure of the moment, do something totally out of character and draw a line, the merest line, under a word or maybe under an entire sentence. I would go so far as to say that every word of this entire letter, so-called, though I haven't read it through to its entirety and won't since I can't find it now, is utterly false. I don't mean false in the sense of untrue, necessarily. There is some truth, perhaps, to the charges. I don't want to quibble. I don't want to appear small in this matter. Things are bad enough already in this department. No. What I want to say, all I want to say, is that while the sentiments expressed in the letter may be my wife's, may even hold some truth, be legitimate, so to speak, the force of the accusations leveled against me is diminished, if not entirely undermined, or even discredited, because she did not, in fact, write the letter. Or if she did write it, then discredited by the fact that she didn't write it in her own handwriting. Such evasion is what makes men hunger for facts. As always, there are some. On the evening in question, we ate dinner rather silently, but not unpleasantly, as was our custom. From time to time, I looked up and smiled across the table as a way of showing my gratitude for the delicious meal. Poached salmon, fresh asparagus, rice pilaf with almonds. The radio played softly in the other room. It was A Little Sweet by Poulenc that I'd first heard on a digital recording 5 years before in an apartment on Van Ness in San Francisco during a thunderstorm. When we'd finished eating, and after we'd had our coffee and dessert, my wife said something that startled me. "Are you planning to be in your room this evening?" she said. "I am," I said. "What did you have in mind?" "I simply wanted to know." She picked up her cup and drank some coffee, but she avoided looking at me, even though I tried to catch her eye. "Are you planning to be in your room this evening?" Such a question was altogether out of character for her. I wonder why on earth I didn't pursue this at the time. She knows my habits, if anyone does. But I think her mind was made up even then. I think she was concealing something even as she spoke. "Of course I'll be in my room this evening," I repeated, perhaps a trifle impatiently. She didn't say anything else, and neither did I. I drank the last of my coffee and cleared my throat. She glanced up and held my eyes for a moment. Then she nodded, as if we had agreed on something. But we hadn't, of course. She got up and began to clear the table. I felt as if dinner had somehow ended on an unsatisfactory note. Something else, a few words maybe, was needed to round things off and put the situation right again. "There's a fog coming in," I said.
"Is there? I hadn't noticed," she said.
She wiped away a place on the window over the sink with a dish towel and looked out. For a minute she didn't say anything. Then she said, again mysteriously, or so it seems to me now,
"There is. Yes, it's very foggy. It's a heavy fog, isn't it?"
That's all she said. Then she lowered her eyes and began to wash the dishes. I sat at the table a while longer before I said, "I think I'll go to my room now." She took her hands out of the water and rested them against the counter. I thought she might proffer a word or two of encouragement for the work I was engaged in, but she didn't. Not a peep. It was as if she were waiting for me to leave the kitchen so she could enjoy her privacy. Remember, I was at work in my room at the time the letter was slipped under the door. I read enough to question the handwriting and to wonder how it was that my wife had presumably been busy somewhere in the house and writing me a letter at the same time. Before reading further in the letter, I got up and went over to the door, unlocked it, and checked the corridor. It was dark at this end of the house.
but when I cautiously put my head out, I could see light from the living room at the end of the hallway. The radio was playing quietly as usual. Why did I hesitate? Except for the fog, it was a night very much like any other we had spent together in the house. But there was something else afoot tonight. At that moment, I found myself afraid. Afraid, if you can believe it, in my own house, to walk down the hall and satisfy myself that all was well. Or if something was wrong, if my wife was experiencing, how should I put it, difficulties of any sort, hadn't I best confront the situation before letting it go any further? Before losing any more time on this stupid business of reading her words in somebody else's handwriting? But I didn't investigate. Perhaps I wanted to avoid a frontal attack. In any case, I drew back and shut and locked the door before returning to the letter. But I was angry now as I saw the evening sliding away in this foolish and incomprehensible business. I was beginning to feel uneasy. No other word will do. I could feel my gorge rising as I picked up the letter purporting to be from my wife and once more began to read. The time has come and gone for us, you and me, to put all our cards on the table. Thee and me, Lancelot and Guinevere, Abelard and Eloise, Troilus and Cressida, Pyramus and Thisbe, J.A.J. and Nora Barnacle, etc. Note, Lancelot through Barnacle. Famed lovers, Lancelot and Guinevere, legendary adulterous couple of Arthurian literature, French theologian Pierre Abelard, 1079 to 1142, and his pupil Eloise, who fell in love, secretly married, and conceived a child together before Abelard was castrated by Eloise's brothers. Their story was recalled in works such as Alexander Pope's 1717 poem, Eloisa to Abelard. Troilus, son of Trojan King Priam and his beloved Cressida, who during the Trojan War is sent to the Greeks and has an affair with the Greek warrior Diomedes, a legend treated in a poem by Chaucer, circa 1380 to 87, and a play by Shakespeare, circa 1603, among others. Pyramus and Thisbe, lovers in Greek mythology, who, forbidden by their parents to marry, arrange a meeting that turns disastrous when Pyramus assumes Thisbe has been killed by a wild beast and kills himself, prompting her to do the same when she discovers his corpse. Irish novelist James Joyce, 1882 to 1941, and his wife Nora, née Barnacle, 1884 to 1951. End of note. You know what I'm saying, honey. We've been together a long time, thick and thin, illness and health, stomach distress, eye, ear, nose, and throat trouble, high times and low. Now? Well, I don't know what I can say now except the truth. I can't go at another step. At this point, I threw down the letter and went to the door again, deciding to settle this once and for all. I wanted an accounting, and I wanted it now. I was, I think, in a rage. But at this point, just as I opened the door, I heard a low murmuring from the living room. It was as if somebody were trying to say something over the phone, and this somebody were taking pains not to be overheard. Then I heard the receiver being replaced. Just this. Then everything was as before. The radio playing softly, the house otherwise quiet. But I had heard a voice. In place of anger, I began to feel panic. I grew afraid as I looked down the corridor. Things were the same as before. The light was on in the living room. The radio played softly. I took a few steps and listened. I hoped I might hear the comforting, rhythmic clicking of her knitting needles, or the sound of a page being turned, but there was nothing of the sort. I took a few steps toward the living room and then, what should I say? I lost my nerve, or maybe my curiosity. It was at that moment I heard the muted sound of a doorknob being turned, and afterward the unmistakable sound of a door opening and closing quietly. My impulse was to walk rapidly down the corridor and into the living room and get to the bottom of this thing once and for all. But I didn't want to act impulsively and possibly discredit myself. I'm not impulsive, so I waited. But there was activity of some sort in the house. Something was afoot, I was sure of it. And of course it was my duty, for my own peace of mind, not to mention the possible safety and well-being of my wife, to act. But I didn't. I couldn't. The moment was there, but I hesitated. Suddenly it was too late for any decisive action. The moment had come and gone, and could not be called back.
Just so did Darius hesitate and then fail to act at the Battle of Granicus, and the day was lost, Alexander the Great rolling him up on every side and giving him a real walloping.
Note. At the Battle of Granicus, 334 BCE, Alexander the Great defeated Persian forces under the command of satraps, provincial governors, serving Persian King Darius III. Darius himself was not at the battle. End of note.
I went back to my room and closed the door, but my heart was racing. I sat in my chair and, trembling, picked up the pages of the letter once more. But now here's the curious thing. Instead of beginning to read the letter through from start to finish, or even starting at the point where I'd stopped earlier, I took pages at random and held them under the table lamp, picking out a line here and a line there. This allowed me to juxtapose the charges made against me until the entire indictment, for that's what it was, took on quite another character, one more acceptable since it had lost its chronology and, with it, a little of its punch. So, well, in this manner, going from page to page, here a line, there a line, I read in snatches the following, which might, under different circumstances, serve as a kind of abstract. Withdrawing farther into a small enough thing, but talcum powder sprayed over the bathroom, including walls and baseboards, a shell, not to mention the insane asylum, until finally, a balanced view, the grave. Your work. Please give me a break. No one, not even, not another word on the subject. The children, but the real issue, not to mention the loneliness. Jesus H. Christ, really, I mean. At this point, I distinctly heard the front door close. I dropped the pages of the letter onto the desk and hurried to the living room. It didn't take long to see that my wife wasn't in the house. The house is small, two bedrooms, one of which we refer to as my room or, on occasion, as my study. But let the record show. Every light in the house was burning. A heavy fog lay outside the windows, a fog so dense I could scarcely see the driveway. The porch light was on, and a suitcase stood outside on the porch. It was my wife's suitcase, the one she'd brought packed full of her things when we moved here. What on earth was going on? I opened the door. Suddenly, I don't know how to say this other than how it was, a horse stepped out of the fog, and then, an instant later, as I watched, dumbfounded, another horse. These horses were grazing in our front yard. I saw my wife alongside one of the horses, and I called her name.
"Come on out here," she said. "Look at this. Doesn't this beat anything?"
She was standing beside this big horse, patting its flank. She was dressed in her best clothes and had on heels and was wearing a hat. I hadn't seen her in a hat since her mother's funeral 3 years before. Then she moved forward and put her face against the horse's mane.
"Where did you come from, you big baby?" she said. "Where did you come from, sweetheart?"
Then, as I watched, she began to cry into the horse's mane. "There, there," I said, and started down the steps. I went over and patted the horse, and then I touched my wife's shoulder. She drew back. The horse snorted, raised its head a moment, and then went to cropping the grass once more. "What is it?" I said to my wife. "For God's sake, what's happening here anyway?" She didn't answer. The horse moved a few steps but continued pulling and eating the grass. The other horse was munching grass as well. My wife moved with the horse, hanging on to its mane. I put my hand against the horse's neck and felt a surge of power run up my arm to the shoulder. I shivered. My wife was still crying. I felt helpless, but I was scared, too. "Can you tell me what's going on?" I said. "Why are you dressed like this? What's that suitcase doing on the front porch? Where did these horses come from? For God's sake, can you tell me what's happening?" My wife began to croon to the horse. "Croon!" Then she stopped and said,
"You didn't read my letter, did you? You might have skimmed it, but you didn't read it. Admit it!"
"I did read it," I said. I was lying, yes, but it was a white lie, a partial untruth. But he who is blameless, let him throw out the first stone.
Note. See Jesus' discussion with the scribes and Pharisees about the stoning of an adulterous woman at John chapter 8, verse 7.
So when they continued asking him, he lifted up himself and said unto them, He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her. End of note.
But tell me what is going on anyway, I said. My wife turned her head from side to side. She pushed her face into the horse's dark wet mane. I could hear the horse chomp, chomp, chomp. Then it snorted as it took in air through its nostrils. She said,
There was this girl, you see. Are you listening? And this girl loved this boy so much. She loved him even more than herself. But the boy, well, he grew up. I don't know what happened to him. Something, anyway. He got cruel without meaning to be cruel, and he...
I didn't catch the rest, because just then a car appeared out of the fog in the drive, with its headlights on and a flashing blue light on its roof. It was followed, a minute later, by a pickup truck, pulling what looked like a horse trailer, though with the fog it was hard to tell. It could have been anything. A big portable oven, say. The car pulled right up onto the lawn and stopped. Then the pickup drove alongside the car and stopped, too. Both vehicles kept their headlights on and their engines running, which contributed to the eerie, bizarre aspect of things. A man wearing a cowboy hat, a rancher, I supposed, stepped down from the pickup. He raised the collar of his sheepskin coat and whistled to the horses. Then a big man in a raincoat got out of the car. He was a much bigger man than the rancher, and he too was wearing a cowboy hat. But his raincoat was open, and I could see a pistol strapped to his waist. He had to be a deputy sheriff. Despite everything that was going on and the anxiety I felt, I found it worth noting that both men were wearing hats. I ran my hand through my hair and was sorry I wasn't wearing a hat of my own.
I called the sheriff's department a while ago, my wife said, when I first saw the horses.
She waited a minute and then she said something else.
Now you won't need to give me a ride into town after all. I mentioned that in my letter, the letter you read. I said I'd need a ride into town. I can get a ride, at least I think I can, with one of these gentlemen. And I'm not changing my mind about anything either. I'm saying this decision is irrevocable. Look at me, she said.
I'd been watching them round up the horses. The deputy was holding his flashlight while the rancher walked a horse up a little ramp into the trailer. I turned to look at this woman I didn't know any longer.
I'm leaving you, she said. That's what's happening. I'm heading for town tonight. I'm striking out on my own. It's all in the letter you read.
Whereas, as I said earlier, my wife never underlined words in her letters, she was now speaking, having dried her tears, as if virtually every other word out of her mouth ought to be emphasized. What's gotten into you? I heard myself say. It was almost as if I couldn't help adding pressure to some of my own words. Why are you doing this? She shook her head. The rancher was loading the second horse into the trailer now, whistling sharply, clapping his hands and shouting an occasional, Whoa, whoa, damn you, back up now, back up. The deputy came over to us with a clipboard under his arm. He was holding a big flashlight. Who called? He said.
I did,
my wife said. The deputy looked her over for a minute. He flashed the light onto her high heels and then up to her hat. You're all dressed up, he said.
I'm leaving my husband, she said.
The deputy nodded as if he understood. But he didn't, he couldn't. He's not going to give you any trouble, is he? The deputy said, shining his light into my face and moving the light up and down rapidly. You're not, are you? No, I said. No trouble, but I resent. Good, the deputy said. Enough said, then. The rancher closed and latched the door to his trailer. Then he walked toward us through the wet grass, which, I noticed, reached to the tops of his boots.
I want to thank you folks for calling, he said. Much obliged. That's one heavy fog. If they'd wandered onto the main road, they could have raised hob out there.
The lady placed the call, the deputy said. Frank, she needs a ride into town. She's leaving home. I don't know who the injured party is here, but she's the one leaving. He turned then to my wife. You sure about this, are you? He said to her. She nodded.
I'm sure.
Okay,
the deputy said. That's settled anyway. Frank, you listening? I can't drive her to town. I've got another stop to make. So can you help her out and take her into town? She probably wants to go to the bus station or else to the hotel. That's where they usually go. Is that where you want to go to? The deputy said to my wife. Frank needs to know. He can drop me off at the bus station, my wife said. That's my suitcase on the porch. What about it, Frank? The deputy said.
I guess I can, sure,
Frank said, taking off his hat and putting it back on again.
I'd be glad to, I guess, but I don't want to interfere in anything.
Not in the least, my wife said. I don't want to be any trouble, but I'm distressed just now. Yes, I'm distressed. But it'll be all right once I'm away from here. Away from this awful place. I'll just check and make doubly sure I haven't left anything behind.
Anything important, she added. She hesitated, and then she said,
This isn't as sudden as it looks. It's been coming for a long, long time. We've been married for a good many years, good times and bad, up times and down. We've had them all. But it's time I was on my own. Yes, it's time. Do you know what I'm saying, gentlemen?
Frank took off his hat again and turned it around in his hands as if examining the brim. Then he put it back on his head. The deputy said,
These things happen. Lord knows none of us is perfect. We weren't made perfect. The only angels is to be found in heaven.
My wife moved toward the house, picking her way through the wet, shaggy grass in her high heels. She opened the front door and went inside. I could see her moving behind the lighted windows, and something came to me then. I might never see her again. That's what crossed my mind, and it staggered me. The rancher, the deputy, and I stood around waiting, not saying anything. The damp fog drifted between us and the lights from their vehicles. I could hear the horses shifting in the trailer. We were all uncomfortable, I think. But I'm speaking only for myself, of course. I don't know what they felt. Maybe they saw things like this happen every night. Saw people's lives flying apart. The deputy did, maybe. But Frank, the rancher, he kept his eyes lowered. He put his hands in his front pockets and then took them out again. He kicked at something in the grass. I folded my arms and went on standing there, not knowing what was going to happen next. The deputy kept turning off his flashlight and then turning it on again. Every so often he'd reach out and swat the fog with it. One of the horses whinnied from the trailer, and then the other horse whinnied too.
A fellow can't see anything in this fog,
Frank said. I knew he was saying it to make conversation.
It's as bad as I've ever seen it, the deputy said.
Then he looked over at me. He didn't shine the light in my eyes this time, but he said something. He said,
Why is she leaving you? You hit her or something? Give her a smack, did you?
I've never hit her, I said. Not in all the time we've been married. There was reason enough a few times, but I didn't. She hit me once, I said.
Now don't get started, the deputy said. I don't want to hear any crap tonight. Don't say anything and there won't be anything. No rough stuff, don't even think it. There isn't going to be any trouble here tonight, is there?
The deputy and Frank were watching me. I could tell Frank was embarrassed. He took out his makings and began to roll a cigarette. No, I said. No trouble. My wife came onto the porch and picked up her suitcase. I had the feeling that not only had she taken a last look around, but she'd used the opportunity to freshen herself up, put on new lipstick, etc. The deputy held his flashlight for her as she came down the steps.
Right this way, ma'am, he said. Watch your step now. It's slippery.
I'm ready to go, she said.
Right, Frank said.
Well, just to make sure we got this all straight now.
He took off his hat once more and held it.
I'll carry you into town, and I'll drop you off at the bus station. But you understand, I don't want to be in the middle of something. You know what I mean.
He looked at my wife, and then he looked at me.
That's right, the deputy said. You said a mouthful. Statistics show that your domestic dispute is, time and again, potentially the most dangerous situation a person, especially a law enforcement officer, can get himself involved in. But I think this situation is going to be the shining exception. Right, folks?
My wife looked at me and said,
I don't think I'll kiss you. No, I won't kiss you goodbye. I'll just say so long. Take care of yourself.
That's right, the deputy said, kissing. Who knows what that'll lead to, right?
He laughed. I had the feeling they were all waiting for me to say something, but for the first time in my life, I felt at a loss for words. Then I took heart and said to my wife, The last time you wore that hat, you wore a veil with it, and I held your arm. You were in mourning for your mother. And you wore a dark dress, not the dress you're wearing tonight. But those are the same high heels I remember. Don't leave me like this, I said. I don't know what I'll do.
I have to, she said. It's all in the letter. Everything's spelled out in the letter. The rest is in the area of, I don't know, mystery or speculation, I guess. In any case, there's nothing in the letter you don't already know.
Then she turned to Frank and said,
Let's go, Frank. I can call you Frank, can't I?
Call him anything you want, the deputy said, long as you call him in time for supper.
He laughed again, a big hearty laugh.
Right, Frank said. Sure you can. Well, okay. Let's go then.
He took the suitcase from my wife and went over to his pickup and put the suitcase into the cab. Then he stood by the door on the passenger's side, holding it open.
I'll write after I'm settled, my wife said. I think I will, anyway. But first things first. We'll have to see.
Now you're talking, the deputy said. Keep all lines of communication open. Good luck, party,
the deputy said to me. Then he went over to his car and got in. The pickup made a wide, slow turn with the trailer across the lawn. One of the horses whinnied. The last image I have of my wife was when a match flared in the cab of the pickup, and I saw her lean over with a cigarette to accept the light the rancher was offering. Her hands were cupped around the hand that held the match. The deputy waited until the pickup and trailer had gone past him, and then he swung his car around, slipping in the wet grass until he found Purchase on the driveway, throwing gravel from under his tires. As he headed for the road, he tooted his horn. Tooted. Historians should use more words like tooted or beeped or blasted, especially at serious moments such as after a massacre or when an awful occurrence has cast a pall on the future of an entire nation. That's when a word like tooted is necessary, is gold in a brass age. I'd like to say it was at this moment, as I stood in the fog watching her drive off, that I remembered a black and white photograph of my wife holding her wedding bouquet. She was 18 years old, a mere girl, and her mother had shouted at me only a month before the wedding. A few minutes before the photo, she'd got married. She's smiling. She's just finished, or is just about to begin, laughing. In either case, her mouth is open in amazed happiness as she looks into the camera. She is 3 months pregnant, though the camera doesn't show that, of course. But what if she is pregnant? So what? Wasn't everybody pregnant in those days? She's happy in any case. I was happy too, I know I was. We were both happy. I'm not in that particular picture, but I was close, only a few steps away, as I remember, shaking hands with someone, offering me good wishes. My wife knew Latin and German and chemistry and physics and history and Shakespeare and all those other things they teach you in private school. She knew how to properly hold a teacup. She also knew how to cook and to make love. She was a prize. But I found this photograph, along with several others, a few days after the horse business, when I was going through my wife's belongings, trying to see what I could throw out and what I should keep. I was packing to move, and I looked at the photograph for a minute, and then I threw it away. I was ruthless. I told myself I didn't care. Why should I care? If I know anything, and I do, if I know the slightest thing about human nature, I know she won't be able to live without me. She'll come back to me. And soon. Let it be soon.
No. I don't know anything about anything, and I never did. She's gone for good. She is. I can feel it. Gone and never coming back. Period. Not ever. I won't see her again, unless we run into each other on the street somewhere. There's still the question of the handwriting. That's a bewilderment. But the handwriting business isn't the important thing, of course. How could it be after the consequences of the letter? Not the letter itself, but the things I can't forget that were in the letter. No, the letter is not paramount at all. There's far more to this than somebody's handwriting. The far more has to do with subtle things. It could be said, for instance, that to take a wife is to take a history. And if that's so, then I understand that I'm outside history now. Like horses and fog. Or you could say that my history has left me. Or that I'm having to go on without history. Or that history will now have to do without me. Unless my wife writes more letters or tells a friend who keeps a diary, say. Then, years later, someone can look back on this time, interpret it according to the record, its scraps and tirades, its silences and innuendos. That's when it dawns on me that autobiography is the poor man's history, and that I am saying goodbye to history. Goodbye, my darling. Errand. Chekhov. On the evening of March 22, 1897, he went to dinner in Moscow with his friend and confidant, Alexei Suvorin. This Suvorin was a very rich newspaper and book publisher, a reactionary, a self-made man whose father was a private at the Battle of Borodino. Like Chekhov, he was the grandson of a serf. They had that in common. Each had peasant's blood in his veins. Otherwise, politically and temperamentally, they were miles apart. Nevertheless, Suvorin was one of Chekhov's few intimates, and Chekhov enjoyed his company. Naturally, they went to the best restaurant in the city, a former townhouse called the Hermitage, a place where it could take hours, half the night even, to get through a 10-course meal that would, of course, include several wines, liqueurs, and coffee. Chekhov was impeccably dressed, as always. A dark suit and waistcoat, his usual pince-nez. He looked that night very much as he looks in the photographs taken of him during this period. He was relaxed, jovial. He shook hands with the maitre d', and with a glance took in the large dining room. It was brilliantly illuminated by ornate chandeliers, the tables occupied by elegantly dressed men and women. Waiters came and went ceaselessly. He had just been seated across the table from Suvorin when suddenly, without warning, blood began gushing from his mouth. Suvorin and two waiters helped him to the gentleman's room and tried to stanch the flow of blood with ice packs. Suvorin saw him back to his own hotel and had a bed prepared for Chekhov in one of the rooms of the suite. Later, after another hemorrhage, Chekhov allowed himself to be moved to a clinic that specialized in the treatment of tuberculosis and related respiratory infections. When Suvorin visited him there, Chekhov apologized for the scandal at the restaurant three nights earlier, but continued to insist there was nothing seriously wrong. He laughed and jested as usual, Suvorin noted in his diary, while spitting blood into a large vessel. Maria Chekhov, his younger sister, visited Chekhov in the clinic during the last days of March. The weather was miserable. A sleet storm was in progress, and frozen heaps of snow lay everywhere. It was hard for her to wave down a carriage to take her to the hospital. By the time she arrived, she was filled with dread and anxiety. Anton Pavlovich lay on his back, Maria wrote in her memoirs. He was not allowed to speak. After greeting him, I went over to the table to hide my emotions. There, among bottles of champagne, jars of caviar, bouquets of flowers from well-wishers, she saw something that terrified her, a freehand drawing, obviously done by a specialist in these matters, of Chekhov's lungs. It was the kind of sketch a doctor often makes in order to show his patient what he thinks is taking place. The lungs were outlined in blue, but the upper parts were filled in with red. I realized they were diseased,
Maria wrote. Leo Tolstoy was another visitor. The hospital staff were awed to find themselves in the presence of the country's greatest writer. The most famous man in Russia. Of course, they had to let him in to see Chekhov, even though non-essential visitors were forbidden. With much obsequiousness on the part of the nurses and resident doctors, the bearded, fierce-looking old man was shown into Chekhov's room. Despite his low opinion of Chekhov's abilities as a playwright, Tolstoy felt the plays were static and lacking in any moral vision. "Where do your characters take you?" he once demanded of Chekhov. "From the sofa to the junk room and back." Tolstoy liked Chekhov's short stories. Furthermore, and quite simply, he loved the man. He told Gorky, "What a beautiful, magnificent man. Modest and quiet, like a girl. He even walks like a girl. He's simply wonderful." And Tolstoy wrote in his journal, everyone kept a journal or a diary in those days, "I am glad I love Chekhov." Tolstoy removed his woolen scarf and bearskin coat, then lowered himself into a chair next to Chekhov's bed. Never mind that Chekhov was taking medication and not permitted to talk, much less carry on a conversation. He had to listen, amazedly, as the Count began to discourse on his theories of the immortality of the soul. Concerning that visit, Chekhov later wrote, "Tolstoy assumes that all of us, humans and animals alike, will live on a principle, such as reason or love, the essence and goals of which are a mystery to us. I have no use for that kind of immortality. I don't understand it, and Lev Nikolaevich was astonished I didn't." Nevertheless, Chekhov was impressed with the solicitude shown by Tolstoy's visit. But unlike Tolstoy, Chekhov didn't believe in an afterlife and never had. He didn't believe in anything that couldn't be apprehended by one or more of his five senses. And as far as his outlook on life and writing went, he once told someone that he lacked a political, religious, and philosophical worldview. "I change it every month, so I'll have to limit myself to the description of how my heroes love, marry, give birth, die, and how they speak." Earlier, before his TB was diagnosed, Chekhov had remarked, "When a peasant has consumption, he says, 'There's nothing I can do. I'll go off in the spring with the melting of the snows.'" Chekhov himself died in the summer during a heat wave. But once Chekhov's own tuberculosis was discovered, he continually tried to minimize the seriousness of his condition. To all appearances, it was as if he felt, right up to the end, that he might be able to throw off the disease as he would a lingering catarrh. Well into his final days, he spoke with seeming conviction of the possibility of an improvement. In fact, in a letter written shortly before his end, he went so far as to tell his sister that he was getting fat and felt much better now that he was in Badenweiler. Badenweiler is a spa and resort city in the western area of the Black Forest, not far from Basel. The Vosges are visible from nearly anywhere in the city, and in those days, the air was pure and invigorating. Russians had been going there for years to soak in the hot mineral baths and promenade on the boulevards. In June 1904, Chekhov went there to die. Earlier that month, he'd made a difficult journey by train from Moscow to Berlin. He traveled with his wife, the actress Olga Knipper, a woman he'd met in 1898 during rehearsals for The Seagull. Her contemporaries describe her as an excellent actress. She was talented, pretty, and almost 10 years younger than the playwright. Chekhov had been immediately attracted to her, but was slow to act on his feelings. As always, he preferred a flirtation to marriage. Finally, after a 3-year courtship involving many separations, letters, and the inevitable misunderstandings, they were at last married in a private ceremony in Moscow on May 25, 1901. Chekhov was enormously happy. He called Olga his pony and sometimes dog or puppy. He was also fond of addressing her as Little Turkey, or simply as My Joy. In Berlin, Chekhov consulted with a renowned specialist in pulmonary disorders, a Dr. Karl Ewald. But according to an eyewitness, after the doctor examined Chekhov, he threw up his hands and left the room without a word. Chekhov was too far gone for help, This Dr. Ewald was furious with himself for not being able to work miracles, and with Chekhov for being so ill. A Russian journalist happened to visit the Chekhovs at their hotel and sent back this dispatch to his editor. Chekhov's days are numbered. He seems mortally ill, is terribly thin, coughs all the time, gasps for breath at the slightest movement, and is running a high temperature. This same journalist saw the Chekhovs off at Potsdam Station when they boarded their train for Badenweiler. According to his account, Chekhov had trouble making his way up the small staircase at the station. He had to sit down for several minutes to catch his breath. In fact, it was painful for Chekhov to move. His legs ached continually, and his insides hurt. The disease had attacked his intestines and spinal cord. At this point, he had less than a month to live. When Chekhov spoke of his condition now, it was, according to Olga, with an almost reckless indifference. Dr. Schwörer was one of the many Badenweiler physicians who earned a good living by treating the well-to-do who came to the spa seeking relief from various maladies. Some of his patients were ill and infirm, others simply old and hypochondriacal. But Chekhov's was a special case. He was clearly beyond help and in his last days. He was also very famous. Even Dr. Schwörer knew his name. He'd read some of Chekhov's stories in a German magazine. When he examined the writer early in June, he voiced his appreciation of Chekhov's art, but kept his medical opinions to himself. Instead, he prescribed a diet of cocoa, oatmeal, drenched in butter, and strawberry tea. This last was supposed to help Chekhov sleep at night. On June 13, less than 3 weeks before he died, Chekhov wrote a letter to his mother, in which he told her his health was on the mend. In it, he said, "It's likely that I'll be completely cured in a week." Who knows why he said this? What could he have been thinking? He was a doctor himself, and he knew better. He was dying. It was as simple and as unavoidable as that. Nevertheless, he sat out on the balcony of his hotel room and read railway timetables. He asked for information on sailings of boats bound for Odessa from Marseille. But he knew. At this stage, he had to have known. Yet in one of the last letters he ever wrote, he told his sister he was growing stronger by the day. He no longer had any appetite for literary work, and hadn't for a long time. In fact, he had very nearly failed to complete The Cherry Orchard the year before. Writing that play was the hardest thing he'd ever done in his life. Toward the end, he was able to manage only 6 or 7 lines a day. "I've started losing heart," he wrote Olga. "I feel I'm finished as a writer, and every sentence strikes me as worthless and of no use whatsoever." But he didn't stop. He finished his play in October 1903. It was the last thing he ever wrote, except for letters and a few entries in his notebook. A little after midnight on July 2, 1904, Olga sent someone to fetch Dr. Schwörer. It was an emergency. Chekhov was delirious. 2 young Russians on holiday happened to have the adjacent room, and Olga hurried next door to explain what was happening. One of the youths was in his bed asleep, but the other was still awake, smoking and reading. He left the hotel at a run to find Dr. Schwörer. "I can still hear the sound of the gravel under his shoes in the silence of that stifling July night," Olga wrote later on in her memoirs. Chekhov was hallucinating, talking about sailors, and there were snatches of something about the Japanese. "You don't put ice on an empty stomach," he said when she tried to place an ice pack on his chest. Dr. Schwörer arrived and unpacked his bag, all the while keeping his gaze fastened on Chekhov, who lay gasping in the bed. The sick man's pupils were dilated and his temples glistened with sweat. Dr. Schwörer's face didn't register anything. He was not an emotional man, but he knew Chekhov's end was near. Still, he was a doctor, sworn to do his utmost, and Chekhov held on to life, however tenuously. Dr. Schwörer prepared a hypodermic and administered an injection of camphor, something that was supposed to speed up the heart. But the injection didn't help. Nothing, of course, could have helped. Nevertheless, the doctor made known to Olga his intention of sending for oxygen. Suddenly, Chekhov roused himself, became lucid, and said quietly, "What's the use? Before it arrives, I'll be a corpse." Dr. Schwörer pulled on his big mustache and stared at Chekhov. The writer's cheeks were sunken and gray, his complexion waxen, his breath was raspy. Dr. Schforer knew the time could be reckoned in minutes. Without a word, without conferring with Olga, he went over to an alcove where there was a telephone on the wall. He read the instructions for using the device. If he activated it by holding his finger on a button and turning a handle on the side of the phone, he could reach the lower regions of the hotel, the kitchen. He picked up the receiver, held it to his ear, and did as the instructions told him. When someone finally answered, Dr. Schforer ordered a bottle of the hotel's best champagne. How many glasses? He was asked. 3 glasses, the doctor shouted into the mouthpiece. And hurry, do you hear? It was one of those rare moments of inspiration that can easily enough be overlooked later on, because the action is so entirely appropriate, it seems inevitable. The champagne was brought to the door by a tired-looking young man whose blonde hair was standing up. The trousers of his uniform were wrinkled, the creases gone, and in his haste he'd missed a loop while buttoning his jacket. His appearance was that of someone who'd been resting, slumped in a chair, say, dozing a little, when off in the distance the phone had clamored in the early morning hours, great God in heaven, and the next thing he knew he was being shaken awake by a superior and told to deliver a bottle of Moet to room 211, and hurry, do you hear? The young man entered the room carrying a silver ice bucket with the champagne in it and a silver tray with 3 cut crystal glasses. He found a place on the table for the bucket and glasses, all the while craning his neck, trying to see into the other room, where someone panted ferociously for breath. It was a dreadful, harrowing sound, and the young man lowered his chin into his collar and turned away as the ratchety breathing worsened. Forgetting himself, he stared out the open window toward the darkened city. Then this big, imposing man with a thick mustache pressed some coins into his hand, a large tip by the feel of it, and suddenly the young man saw the door open. He took some steps and found himself on the landing, where he opened his hand and looked at the coins in amazement. Methodically, the way he did everything, the doctor went about the business of working the cork out of the bottle. He did it in such a way as to minimize, as much as possible, the festive explosion. He poured 3 glasses and, out of habit, pushed the cork back into the neck of the bottle. He then took the glasses of champagne over to the bed. Olga momentarily released her grip on Chekhov's hand, a hand, she said later, that burned her fingers. She arranged another pillow behind his head. Then she put the cool glass of champagne against Chekhov's palm and made sure his fingers closed around the stem. They exchanged looks, Chekhov, Olga, Dr. Schforer. They didn't touch glasses. There was no toast. What on earth was there to drink to? To death? Chekhov summoned his remaining strength and said, "It's been so long since I've had champagne." He brought the glass to his lips and drank. In a minute or two, Olga took the empty glass from his hand and set it on the nightstand. Then Chekhov turned onto his side. He closed his eyes and sighed. A minute later, his breathing stopped. Dr. Schforer picked up Chekhov's hand from the bedsheet. He held his fingers to Chekhov's wrist and drew a gold watch from his vest pocket, opening the lid of the watch as he did so. The second hand on the watch moved slowly, very slowly. He let it move around the face of the watch 3 times while he waited for signs of a pulse. It was 3 o'clock in the morning and still sultry in the room. Badenweiler was in the grip of its worst heat wave in years. All the windows in both rooms stood open, but there was no sign of a breeze. A large, black-winged moth flew through a window and banged wildly against the electric lamp. Dr. Schforer let go of Chekhov's wrist. "It's over," he said. He closed the lid of his watch and returned it to his vest pocket. At once, Olga dried her eyes and set about composing herself. She thanked the doctor for coming. He asked if she wanted some medication, laudanum perhaps, or a few drops of valerian. She shook her head. She did have one request, though. Before the authorities were notified and the newspapers found out, before the time came when Chekhov was no longer in her keeping, she wanted to be alone with him for a while. Could the doctor help with this? Could he withhold, for a while anyway, news of what had just occurred? Dr. Schforer, stroked his mustache with the back of a finger. Why not? After all, what difference would it make to anyone whether this matter became known now or a few hours from now? The only detail that remained was to fill out a death certificate, and this could be done at his office later on in the morning, after he'd slept a few hours. Dr. Schforer nodded his agreement and prepared to leave. He murmured a few words of condolence. Olga inclined her head. An honor, Dr. Schforer said. He picked up his bag and left the room and, for that matter, history. It was at this moment that the cork popped out of the champagne bottle. Foam spilled down onto the table. Olga went back to Chekhov's bedside. She sat on a footstool, holding his hand, from time to time stroking his face. There were no human voices, no everyday sounds, she wrote. There was only beauty, peace, and the grandeur of death. She stayed with Chekhov until daybreak, when thrushes began to call from the garden below. Then came the sound of tables and chairs being moved about down there. Before long, voices carried up to her. It was then a knock sounded at the door. Of course, she thought it must be an official of some sort, the medical examiner, say, or someone from the police who had questions to ask and forms for her to fill out. Or maybe, just maybe, it could be Dr. Schforer returning with a mortician to render assistance in embalming and transporting Chekhov's remains back to Russia. But instead, it was the same blonde young man who'd brought the champagne a few hours earlier. This time, however, his uniform trousers were neatly pressed, with stiff creases in front, and every button on his snug green jacket was fastened. He seemed quite another person. Not only was he wide awake, but his plump cheeks were smooth-shaven, his hair was in place, and he appeared anxious to please. He was holding a porcelain vase with three long-stemmed yellow roses. He presented these to Olga with a smart click of his heels. She stepped back and let him into the room. He was there, he said, to collect the glasses, ice bucket, and tray, yes. But he also wanted to say that, because of the extreme heat, breakfast would be served in the garden this morning. He hoped this weather wasn't too bothersome. He apologized for it. The woman seemed distracted. While he talked, she turned her eyes away and looked down at something in the carpet. She crossed her arms and held her elbows. Meanwhile, still holding his vase, waiting for a sign, the young man took in the details of the room. Bright sunlight flooded through the open windows. The room was tidy and seemed undisturbed, almost untouched. No garments were flung over chairs, no shoes, stockings, braces, or stays were in evidence, no open suitcases. In short, there was no clutter, nothing but the usual heavy pieces of hotel room furniture. Then, because the woman was still looking down, he looked down too, and at once spied a cork near the toe of his shoe. The woman did not see it. She was looking somewhere else. The young man wanted to bend over and pick up the cork, but he was still holding the roses and was afraid of seeming to intrude even more by drawing any further attention to himself. Reluctantly, he left the cork where it was and raised his eyes. Everything was in order except for the uncorked, half-empty bottle of champagne that stood alongside two crystal glasses over the little table. He cast his gaze about once more. Through an open door, he saw that the third glass was in the bedroom on the nightstand, but someone still occupied the bed. He couldn't see a face, but the figure under the covers lay perfectly motionless and quiet. He noted the figure and looked elsewhere. Then, for a reason he couldn't understand, a feeling of uneasiness took hold of him. He cleared his throat and moved his weight to the other leg. The woman still didn't look up or break her silence. The young man felt his cheeks grow warm. It occurred to him, quite without his having thought it through, that he should perhaps suggest an alternative to breakfast in the garden. He coughed, hoping to focus the woman's attention, but she didn't look at him. The distinguished foreign guests could, he said, take breakfast in their rooms this morning if they wished. The young man, his name hasn't survived, and it's likely he perished in the Great War, said he would be happy to bring up a tray. Two trays, he added, glancing uncertainly once again in the direction of the bedroom. He fell silent and ran a finger around the inside of his collar. He didn't understand. He wasn't even sure the woman had been listening. He didn't know what else to do now. He was still holding the vase. The sweet odor of the roses filled his nostrils and inexplicably caused a pang of regret. The entire time he'd been waiting, the woman had apparently been lost in thought. It was as if all the while he'd been standing there, talking, shifting his weight, holding his flowers, she had been someplace else, somewhere far from Badenweiler. But now she came back to herself, and her face assumed another expression. She raised her eyes, looked at him, and then shook her head. She seemed to be struggling to understand what on earth this young man could be doing there in the room, holding a vase with three yellow roses. Flowers. She hadn't ordered flowers. The moment passed. She went over to her handbag and scooped up some coins. She drew out a number of banknotes as well. The young man touched his lips with his tongue. Another large tip was forthcoming, but for what? What did she want him to do? He'd never before waited on such guests. He cleared his throat once more. No breakfast, the woman said, not yet at any rate. Breakfast wasn't the important thing this morning. She required something else. She needed him to go out and bring back a mortician. Did he understand her? Herr Chekhov was dead, you see. Comprenez-vous? Note, French, do you understand? End of note. Young man, Anton Chekhov was dead. Now listen carefully to me, she said. She wanted him to go downstairs and ask someone at the front desk where he could go to find the most respected mortician in the city, someone reliable, who took great pains in his work and whose manner was appropriately reserved. A mortician, in short, worthy of a great artist. Here, she said, and pressed the money on him. Tell them downstairs that I have specifically requested you to perform this duty for me. Are you listening? Do you understand what I'm saying to you? The young man grappled to take in what she was saying. He chose not to look again in the direction of the other room. He had sensed that something was not right. He became aware of his heart beating rapidly under his jacket, and he felt perspiration break out on his forehead. He didn't know where he should turn his eyes. He wanted to put the vase down.